Coming up next is the Professor James McCanny Science Hour at the Crossroads. Now on shortwave, WWCR, frequency 5.070 at 7 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays, and also on Reality Radio Network Internet at www.realityradionetwork.com on Thursday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. And now, once again, here's your host, the Professor.
Good evening, January 17th, 2008, and yes, it is 2008. Just an apology for last week, I used the 2007 for the year, and so I apologize for that. I hope I didn't confuse too many people, but hopefully you found out soon in the discussion that I was really in 2008. So sorry about that. And I looked back in my notes, I'd actually written it in my notes. And so it is 2008, so sorry about last week. And I'll try and remain in 2008 for this lecture. Anyway, I'm going to go fairly quickly into the science lecture for tonight, which will cover a discussion of the so-called debate over evolution versus creationism. Now, I'll just give you a summary to begin with. Of course, I'm sure everybody has heard that there's a big debate in the scientific community and amongst people who read the Bible and take it literally. That's the main crux of the issue, that evolution is not true, that's stated by the creationists, and then evolutionists say that science reigns supreme and the Bible is some kind of a fictitious book. And really, in any kind of scientific endeavor, there is a reality. And in any type of religious or denominational in their world, there is a reality too, and those realities have to have to meet because there is only one reality. So what we're talking about here are two interpretations of what possibly happened in the past. So one is a belief mechanism for creationism. And then the scientists claim that they have some kind of inside track on ultimate knowledge to understand exactly what happened. So, but as I say, there's one reality, and instead of arguing, well, I'm not going to cure that debate on this show, but what I am going to talk about is the conflict between what science is doing today and reality. And so if scientists want to claim knowledge and to be the people who tell everybody else what's going on the planet, then they better get their own story straight first. And so that's part of the issue regarding dates as interpreted in, say, the Bible, the Old Testament. I've been down this road too, and there are many different interpretations of dates. And so dating is something that's very difficult. You find various interpretations, and as I said, some people say that the earth was created 4,000 years ago, or some would say 7,000 years ago. And but anyway, the point of tonight's discussion is to talk about the cosmology that is being forced on the public today. And there's a real series of issues with this. So let me begin. And actually, last week I talked about this article where astronomers were talking about the birth of a comet. And it's getting more goofy, ridiculous, and of course this being printed in places like space.com, in the journals, the so-called respectable journals like Science and Nature, Here's the article that I read from last week, and I'll just review it again right now, but it has to do with dust. Now, we're going to find in this discussion that dust in the cosmos is a very big issue, and in us using a little tongue-in-cheek expression, is being literally swept under the rug by astronomers. Now, when they recently had two space probes, one was to sample the solar wind, the other, called Stardust, was to fly through a comet tail and sample the dust that was in the comet tail, and then bring that sample back to Earth and open it up and let scientists look at the dust. And of course, what they expected to find was some kind of, I suppose, what you find in your house, lint or something. Is there space lint? Maybe from, people out there that wear wool sweaters. I don't know what they were expecting. But what they found was very hot composite material, material that was formed under very high temperatures and pressures. So, basically the only other source we know for these composite materials is, they're called igneous rocks. These small particles, the only place we know these form are in volcanic regions on Earth. So there may be other celestial processes that are very hot and would give us these same particles. But the fact is that is what they discovered. In fact, about a third of the dust particles found are of these type, remnants of extremely hot processes. So in light of this discovery, scientists who dominate the comet world in the popular press and in the so-called standard scientific respectable journals. There's a lot of good science going on in the background these days, but the comet people are the ones that are dragging their feet, and really that's one of the major problems in science today. Also, Big Bang cosmology. That's where we're going to find out. And the source of this dust in space, obviously it is very common in space, but what they're now saying is, oh, well, this dust formed very near the sun. It was bombarded by noble gases, which would be like argon and helium, those type of gases, the gases that do not interact with other chemicals because they have a full outer valence bond of electrons, but these very high temperature profile little dust particles, minerals, etc., were then bombarded by the noble gases, which, by the way, shouldn't have even been around, some of them in the early solar system, but according to standard science, But here's the point. Then they say, well, these dust particles that apparently formed near the sun went whizzing out beyond Neptune. Now, I remember reading back in the 70s and back in, it was in the 80s also, there were some imposter pseudoscientists, non-scientists running around and unfortunately trying to defend Velikovsky. And, of course, the whole issue with Velikovsky and the issue of comets becoming planets, clearly we have one right now, Comet Holmes, up in the sky. Everybody can see it. It's not going away and is forming a minor planet. As we speak, everybody can look up and see this in the night sky, and it's getting bigger and bigger. The coma, the dusty cloud around this comet, is literally the volume area, or the volume of this comet tail in three dimensions, is literally right now about eight times the size of our sun, if you can imagine that. And so, anyway, back to this idea that all of a sudden these particles were formed near the sun and magically went whizzing out beyond the orbit of Neptune. All of this magical stuff, and the reason I brought up the imposters is because that's the kind of pseudoscience that they were proposing. Well, Saturn was out there, and then it went whizzing around, and it became the North Pole of Earth, and it sat there for years, and then it went whizzing back out to where it was, and everything was just fine. Just garbage, you know. But you find now that standard astronomers are following this same path. When things become unexplainable, they just make things up. So why is that important in the evolution creationist argument discussion? Because dust, where does dust come from in outer space is a very important point. Because if the dust out there is forming in very heated environments, very high temperature, high pressure in environments, and by the way, I'm going to bring in the topic of meteorites, these little rocky objects that fall to Earth, and we find them every now and then. And obviously, these objects have formed under extreme pressures. The crystalline structures we see, the metallic conditions in these little rocky objects, all very obviously forming under very high pressure, high density conditions, high temperature. And astronomers continue to say that, oh, these formed in the early solar system, and they just, they just formed out there, and little dust particles collapsed on little dust particles. You have to understand that gravity for a particle that size, a little rock, is literally zero. There's no gravitational attraction, and there's no ability for these objects to coalesce other than just by colliding into each other, and usually things are whipping around out there so fast that a collision means destruction, not adding material to the particular object that gets hit. So once again, this whole idea of where does dust come from? What does it look like out there? What's its composition? And the question is, where does it really come from? Well, that answers a lot of questions, because this dust material, the little rocks, the little asteroids, all look like they came from some larger object that was either blown apart or collided in the past. And we do see exploding galaxies. We see exploding stars. We see these objects lifting off. We see our own sun lifting off its entire surface in explosions called coronal mass ejections. We just had a couple about 2 weeks ago, December 31st and January 2nd. We had two coronal mass ejections of our very own sun, which are surface explosions. And so in a Big Bang cosmology, where supposedly everything came out of this infinitesimally small dot, you know, 12 billion years ago, and most of it being hydrogen, it does not account for dust that formed in hot places. And when you start to look at the real explanations for how the solar system works, how the universe works, how galaxies work, you will find that there is a very clear evidence that the universe is ongoing. It is a continual regenerating process. In other words, galaxies grow, they get to be too big, they explode, the stars in them eventually get to be very large and fall back into the central galactic region and explode, and that's where a lot of this dust comes from, and the particulate matter and larger atoms, etc., in the universe. So understanding that dust that we see formed in a very hot, very high temperature, very high pressure area shows that this material came from previous stars, galaxies, planets, etc. And that is very important, because now we see in just the fact that this dust is out there that the universe is a continually regenerating place. That's what science is telling us. That is the literal interpretation of what we're seeing with experimental results out in the wider universe. Let's look at the Big Bang idea, that everything was generated in a single explosion. And by the way, it's very presumptuous for astronomers to make some kind of a claim right now, especially given our very rudimentary view of the entire universe. Every time you hear another announcement, somebody discovered something that was closer to the Big Bang, yet it's out in all directions. And I've said this before, if the Big Bang did occur, then as you go out and see objects farther and farther away, they should become centralized in a certain part of the sky, and that would be where the Big Bang originally occurred. But you don't see that. Now they're claiming they can see objects 500 million years after the Big Bang, which is almost instantaneous in terms of the 12 or 13 or 14 billion years that they claim the age of the universe, and they're all over the sky. They're not localized to one particular location. So all kinds of contradictions here. The list of contradictions goes on, and I might have time to touch on those. But the fact is that the more we look, the more the data and information coming back from big telescopes and space probes, the more it contradicts the Big Bang and the idea that dust somehow formed on its own out there and all of a sudden became incorporated in some kind of snowy little snowball that became a comet. These are illusionary, and as I said, these are the biggest drawbacks today to science. So let me go through the actual scenario that is unfolding experimentally, and these are the same scenarios that I put in my theoretical work 30 years ago, and there was good reason back then to understand that the Big Bang was incorrect, and that dust and objects coming in from outer space, little rocky objects, dust, etc., was created in some other environment other than outer space, that it was created in a very high pressure, high temperature environment. So let me use one more analogy here before I go on. Say you walked into the middle of a woods. You've never been in this woods before, and you look around you, and you see the first thing you're going to see are the big full-growth trees. And then you're going to look down to the ground, and you're going to see some little trees that are just sprouting from seeds. And you're going to see mid-sized trees. You're going to see branches breaking off the big trees. You're going to see things on the ground like branches and fallen over trees that didn't make it. They didn't get enough sunlight. They got weak, they were frail, they died and fell over. You see mushrooms and fungus growing on the old trees. You look down on the ground and there's a very thick layer of humus and dirt underneath, say, some moss or other small forest plants that are growing. You see all of this and you look around, and what if you said to yourself, this all began in a Big Bang 12 billion years ago. And before that, there was nothing, and all of a sudden, here was the forest. And all of the trees, etc. Well, there's a gap in there. And that's what's happening in astronomy. When we go out in the universe, we see galaxies that are well formed. We see old galaxies. We see new galaxies forming. We see quasars, which are giving off a tremendous amount of energy. And they're right next to the old galaxies. When we look at them physically, they're actually connected. And you can see this. But astronomers ignore all of these principles. Now, when I was very early in my work here, back in the late 1970s, early 1980s, I contacted a guy named Halton Arp. And he was one of the first pioneers, and there's a whole list of them now, who have taken photographs of galaxies showing that they are connected with high redshift objects like quasars. In Big Bang cosmology, the claim is that quasars are at the edge of the universe because of their high redshift. So I knew back then that there was some other source of redshift. So I went to work, and was, as with all of my work, I know what the major problems are and what has to be solved. And so in my very earliest work, I discovered a physical principle and named it the induced electric dipole redshift. And what this amounts to is, also when I was discovering my comet work, I realized that stars and galactic nuclei, any object with fusion, was producing a non-uniform electric field. These are the same fields that form the capacitors that the comet nuclei discharge when I talk about my plasma discharge comet model. So you have a central object like a star or a quasar or a galactic nucleus with the fusion process going on. And what I discovered is there had to be an excess current of protons. Those are the positively charged nuclear particles that come out of our sun. We know that. There are also electrons, negatively charged particles that come out of the sun. But for some reason, which I'm not going to go into in this show, there is an excess of protons coming out, which leaves the sun with a net negative charge and creates a large capacitor out in our solar system beyond the orbit of Pluto. Probably about two or three times that distance would be the capacitor in our solar system. So you have what is known as a non-uniform electric field. And so at any rate, the redshift I discovered was actually due to light emanating from the central star and passing through this non-uniform electric field. And I called it the induced electric dipole redshift because there is a pair of charges in every little photon of light. And that causes a slightly restrictive force, a centralized attractive force by the central star. And as these objects leave a quasar, a galactic nucleus, etc., a star like our own, they obtain a slight redshift. So the bigger the electric field, the bigger the redshift. So the redshifts that astronomers are seeing all over the universe and trying to map the universe is a result not of motion of the star, but of the electrical conditions around that star. So let's go, and I'm going to take a little diversion here into something called dark energy and dark matter. A long time ago, decades ago, astronomers were realizing that their theories regarding galaxies, etc., weren't adding up. Gravity alone did not explain the shape of the galactic arms. It did not explain a lot of things. So they invented what they called dark matter. There has to be something out there we can't see. And now the big search is for dark matter and dark energy, things that we just can't see. They're predicting they're going to find this in the next couple years. But unfortunately, they're chasing a wild goose around the barnyard, basically, because the problem is with their initial theories, not with a need for finding something that pretty much the rest of us know is not there. The big problem is these astronomers have dominated both the press, the journals, and the equipment for decades, and they won't give it up. It's like a spoiled kid who's gone to play baseball at the park, and he happens to be the wealthiest kid, so he brings the bat and the baseball and the glove, and always claims that he's the winner. That's what we got going on in the astronomy, cosmology, astrophysics world today. And so they have worked their way up into the funding mechanism, into the journals, and into the distribution of time on very expensive equipment. And unfortunately, all of it is going towards these dead-end searches for dark matter, for the highest redshift objects, and nobody can get a word in edgewise. Now, there's a lot of other scientists out there who are starting to realize that there's something wrong with this picture, but they're almost helpless because of this large, and it's like a fortress being built by the cosmology people. That brings us up to a topic of last year's Nobel Prize. And I've talked about this before, a very highly politicized Nobel Prize, giving it to two NASA employees who worked back in the Kobe days, when I believe it was about 1989, there was a satellite that was sent up to look at the microwave background radiation signature. That's the very faint, very cold microwave signals coming from outer space. And these scientists were participating in the Nobel Prize. They won it in 2007. Somewhat locking in for posterity. Now, when something is given a Nobel Prize, it's usually based on some kind of very serious fact that is identified throughout the scientific community as a great advancement. This is very unfortunate that the Nobel Committee was allowing a highly political prize to be given two employees of NASA, which actually broke their rules because people have to do independent research to get the Nobel Prize. One of the rules is it's not supposed to come from government-funded or big funding organizations like governments because of the fact that this becomes highly political. So right now not only are we strapped with this big fortress of bad science based on Big Bang cosmology, dark matter, dark energy, and the searches for these. They're talking about them like an attorney that's gone into a court case and hasn't even presented his evidence and is already claiming he won. That's what's going on. Now they're claiming, oh, well, we're going to find dark energy and dark matter in the next couple of years. Well, I'm sorry, but it's really dominating the use of all this great equipment. What I'm going to go into now is the real picture for cosmology, and it includes, of course, comets. Comets are very instrumental here, and we found out that when they sent the Stardust mission out there to discover the type of dust in the comet tails, that it came back with the correct answer. Once again, the interpretation that it was given by standard science is all wet and all wrong. The correct interpretation, and the very simple, very obvious interpretation, is that dust in the universe is in general created by very explosions of objects that were very hot, that had very high temperatures and pressures, and that's where the majority of dust came from in our solar system and in the universe. Then you look at galaxies forming. They are basically consuming dust. Comets are drawing in this dust and becoming bigger. That's the correct explanation. So comets are not giving off this dust. They are gathering it in. So the dust came from someplace else, and as usual, astronomers have the entire story backwards. The material in the comet tail is coming into the comet, therefore the dust in the comet tail came from some place else, some other place. In this story where it formed near the sun in the early days of the solar system and then went whizzing out to beyond Neptune, where it then became part of a comet, is just ludicrous. It's ridiculous, and it's one of the worst forms of bad science that I have ever seen. And as I said, it borderlines on the goofy pseudoscientists, science, etc., that was going on around the Velikovsky days, where you had untrained scientists or untrained people claiming they were scientists coming up with voodoo science And that's one of the big reasons why they criticized Velikovsky. It wasn't Velikovsky, it was the nutcases that formed around him, and many of them still floating around the internet, coming up with all kinds of wacko ideas. Like one of the wacko ideas out there is that the sun is powered from outside. You know, just ridiculous, goofy stuff that doesn't make any sense at all by measurement, by experimentation, or by theory. Yet people are making these claims. So we have it in the standard scientific community now. Ridiculous claims that don't make any sense. Let me talk about how I developed my theoretical work back in the late 1970s and early 80s, and which has continued up to this day to be the central core of my weather work, which I'm sure you're all familiar with my predictions and how they've come true to the T, to the minute in many cases. I can predict weather months in advance on a particular date, based on my analysis of the electrical conditions in the solar system. This is just one of the offshoots of the electrical understanding that I came to many decades ago. Now, one of the central core pieces of this was actually the one of the first papers I published in the standard journals called Galactic Evolution, continuing process of galactic evolution. That was one of my first papers, and published, as I said, in the standard astrophysics journals. I'm just going to look here one second, and I'm going to get the date and the publication. This was in Astrophysics and Space Science. The name of the topic, it was 1981, Continuing Galactic Formation, A New Concept of Galactic Evolution, J.M. McCanney, author, Department of Mathematics, Cornell University, received May 2nd, 1980. And so, of course, that work being done in the late 70s, being published in the journal Astrophysics and Space Science in early 1981. Here's what it says. Galaxies form as dust clouds collapse. Well, where did this dust come from? Clearly, it came from prior galaxies that exploded, sending this dust and material all over the universe, eventually to be recollected by other galaxies. So dust and gases were coalescing and rotating, and as the dust and gases came into the nuclear region of the galaxy, of the galactic nucleus, it melted, heated up, formed stars, and these star systems were then thrown out to become the arms. So the stars, the new stars like our star, or like any star in the galactic system, actually formed near the galactic nucleus and then was thrown out like a giant gravitational sprinkler system, in a sense. And so the orbits of these stars go out, and we are in the far reaches of the galactic system in the Milky Way, our Milky Way galaxy system, And eventually our sun will go out, and it's probably near the very edge of its orbit, and then swing back in, and billions of years from now collapse back into the sun, or the central region of the solar system, the big star sun-like object that's in the center of our galaxy. So we're out here cruising along in the far reaches of the galaxy, and all of the stars are coming in very similar path. This was verified by measurements taken by astronomers showing that the majority of movement of stars in the galaxy is actually radial, coming out from the center of the galaxy or moving back in towards the center of the galaxy, and not in a rotational orbital direction around the central part of the galaxy as you would expect if these were big circular orbits. So basically, the galaxies form and then explode, form, explode, just like trees grow, become overgrown, die, fall down, decay, and that material then becomes the next generation tree. It becomes the dirt and the nutrition for the next generation of trees. So the analogy with a forest is very consistent with what's going on in the universe. So you can see that dust is an understanding where dust comes from is an essential, very important part of our understanding of the cosmology. Where does dust come from? And in this idea that it's somehow formed near the sun, there are all kinds of flaws in that reasoning, because you need high pressure, high temperature, and where does the high pressure come from with things out in outer space where you're dealing with the vacuum of outer space? How do you form igneous rock in the vacuum of outer space? All of these concepts are what we call gee whiz concepts. They even use the word whizzing as the gases whizzed out at high speed to penetrate these little igneous rocks, which we found as dust particles around the tail of Comet Vilt, for example, with the Stardust mission. So understanding the origin of dust in outer space, the origin of small rocks, what we call meteorites when they come into the atmosphere, understanding their origin and that they came from previously existing stars, planets, etc., that are asteroids in the asteroid belt, are a collection of objects that probably came from old planets, old stars, old objects, and they're a collection possibly of objects that accrued there when prior planets of our solar system were smashed into and destroyed. And many of them also, we know, have been captured. So it's probably a mixture, but at any rate, even the ones that were captured had to have come from some larger object that got smashed to smithereens during a galactic explosion or some kind of interstellar collision. So understanding the origin of these objects and that they just didn't form out there just willy-nilly, couple dust particles colliding and sticking together, like we're told. So let me enumerate the things that are incorrect with standard science. The Big Bang is incorrect. When astronomers look out and see redshifts of objects in the universe, when they see these redshifts and interpret them, this all began with Edwin Hubble. And at the time, it was an okay idea because relativity had just come in. The idea of redshifts was new. And at the time, it was an okay idea. But its time has passed, and the data does not support it. So the Big Bang, that everything began in a single large explosion coming from a single point where all matter came from, is a ridiculous, dead, outdated idea. It has to go away before progress can be made in cosmology. And the key to that is understanding that the redshifts are inherent in the object. The quasar, the galactic nucleus, our very own sun, our very own star gives off a redshift, and astronomers cannot explain it. Well, the reason is the induced electric dipole redshift, which is my theoretical work from the late 1970s, which gives the explanation for why there is a redshift. There is also a redshift due to movement, but oddly enough, in the theoretical work, it shows how to differentiate between the localized self-induced redshift, the induced electric dipole redshift. You can tell the difference between that and the movement redshift. So there are two sources of redshift, but in your measurements, if you take the measurements correctly, you can tell the difference. And that's why the telescope time being dominated by these Big Bang astronomers is really incorrect. And until we get those guys out of the picture and get scientists in the picture managing that equipment that are looking for the real data, they're going to be on a wild goose chase for dark matter and dark energy, making claims they've discovered it, just like they're making the claims they've discovered black holes at all kinds of other exotic objects out there, when really what they're looking at is very much signatures of electrical activity in the cosmos. But at any rate, the Big Bang is a big problem for cosmology. The origin of dust is a big problem. It has to be identified correctly. And the last big problem in cosmology, astrophysics, and space science is the so-called dirty snowball comet model. It has to go. It is ridiculous how anybody can still hang on to that ridiculous piece of theoretical work. And once again, at the time, there may have been a little bit of reason to hold on to it, but even as early as 1950, there was plenty of evidence to show that comets were not dirty snowballs. They could not be dirty snowballs. Never would be, never will be. But nobody ever was allowed to look in that direction. That's when I came along at Cornell in 1979 to 81 and saw the data. It supported my previous theoretical work showing that comets are in fact a discharge of the plasma capacitor that surrounds our sun. So that is the third piece. So the three big pieces of cosmology that have to go away: the Big Bang, the idea that dust somehow formed in our solar system in outer space by itself, that's ridiculous, and the dirty snowball comet model. All those are the three major pins holding up astronomy, cosmology, astrophysics, space science. Those are the three pins that have to be totally removed. And I already replaced them with the, as I said, the induced electric dipole redshift explains where the redshifts are coming from. So that carries that part of the new pin that has to be placed. The idea that galaxies and stars form and then are destroyed, just like trees in a forest grow, fall over, and decay. The same thing happens with galaxies, stars, etc. They have a lifetime, and when they're done, they explode, and all that material goes back out into the universe to be recaptured at a later date by another star or another galaxy or a comet that is becoming a planet. So then the last piece, of course, the plasma discharge comet model replaces the dirty snowball comet model, and now you understand where planets come from. Not all comets are becoming planets. Some of them are little, some of them are poor attempts, but there are statistically enough of them that get into the correct orbit, that get the correct initial discharge, just like Comet Holmes is now becoming a minor planet. It's in a good orbit. It's had electrical connections with many of the inner planets, also with Jupiter. And so it will continue to grow and become a comet. Once those electrical discharges form, they continue on and on. And that's why astronomers, that's why astronomers do not understand why Comet Holmes can still be there, growing and growing and growing. And that's why you find kind of mum from the astronomers. They print these gee whiz articles in like space.com or in the magazine Science. And you have to understand, let me divert my attention to this. You have to understand that this is tier two science. These are the scientists who really are allowed to do incorrect science, because the understanding of correct science, I've been explaining week after week, the many reasons why they don't want you to know that comets are dirty snowballs. One of them, as I talked about last week, was because of the electric fields and electric propulsion systems that can be used for travel, used for space flight, that type of thing. They don't want the public in space, period. That's the end of that story. They also, if you understood that comets are plasma discharge in the solar system, then you understand that there's vast amounts of electrical power out there that we can tap into. Tesla was doing that at the beginning of the 1900s. And once again, when you read anything about Tesla, they always want to tell you he was collecting power with his towers. That's the standard story that has evolved. It's an eroded, incorrect story. What Tesla was really doing was collecting power. If Tesla were distributing power with his tower, you have to ask the question, where was he getting all his power to distribute? Because Westinghouse had already purchased all the rights to all the existing generation, electrical generation equipment at the time. So where was Tesla supposed to get all the power that he was going to distribute? Well, the answer is that he was getting it for free from the Earth capacitor between the ionosphere and Earth, the same electrical power system that drives our weather systems, the same electrical power systems that drive hurricanes and tornadoes and storms, thunderstorms, lightning storms, etc. So once again, you see that all of the weather, the meteorology that is being used today is totally incorrect because it doesn't include the most important factor, which is the electrical conditions in the solar system. One by one, scientists are starting to grab on to these ideas, but unfortunately, they'll take ideas like electricity or electrical storms over Africa forming hurricanes, and then they mix it into the old incorrect meteorology. So the growing pains that are going on in, say, meteorology, the study of weather, or the study of conditions around moons and planets in our solar system, or around quasars, or cosmology, or the origin of dust, all of this is being hampered and diverted because of very bad Tier 2 science. And this is an allowed bad science because they simply don't want the public to know what the real story is. There are too many implications. Big oil would go away. There would be no more need for the nuclear industry. These are the major influences in government today. You find that the powers... Oops, I'm losing my voice. Just a second. You find that the powers that operate the World Bank, which controls the governments, that controls the CIA, which is the police force of the World Bank, you find out that their plan includes big oil. Their plan includes control of large energy on the planet. So you find that the game plan of the people who are in control, that control the, for example, the Bush-Clinton White House that has been going on for decades and actually has been going on prior to that, back into when Tesla was around, he was driving electric cars. Early in the 1900s, there was a big effort to promote electric cars, and that should have been the source of our power, that should have been the source of our industrial efforts, free power, unlimited free power from the ionosphere, and used in a very controlled manner, we would have fewer damaging storms and a much stronger economy. So you find that around the same time, the illegal taxation of individuals, interest on national loans, the national debt began to form around wars. You find that these things happened, and the people in the United States, Europe, Russia, and all of these China's developing Japan, all became pawns of this international plan to subjugate the populations of the world to the benefit of a very few families. That's their game plan, and they realized early on that Tesla had to be suppressed and what he was actually doing. So you find, as I said, an increasing effort today to suppress the real work of Tesla. He had cars that he could drive around tapping into this vertical electric field and drive them around for free. In a world like today, you wouldn't have your own solar or electrical collector, you would have large public utility collectors that would distribute it on the same grid system we have today, and distribute the energy around the country, instead of having vast hurricanes destroying our shorelines, we would be tapping into them offshore, draining that electrical energy and distributing that energy up to the populous areas and the industrialized areas to run our society, instead of being drained daily because of big oil, because of the incredible lock that these corporations and controlling entities have on our daily lives. It's a very bad situation in the world today, being controlled. So now you might have an idea why this bad science, the Big Bang, the goofy, ridiculous Tier 2 science revolving around dust and the origin of dust, the efforts to keep electrical information on the solar system and our weather, etc., to keep that from the public, and to keep, for example, my plasma discharge comet model from the public, because the next question would be, well, if there's all of this free electrical energy out there, why are we not using it? Why do we have nuclear power plants? Why do we have coal power plants? Why do we use oil to run a great deal of our transportation? It should all be done with electricity. That electricity should be for free. And this would cut into the big plans of the controllers, who set up a plan over 100 years ago. And interest, by the way, let's talk about that as part of the controlling mechanism. The interest charged on national debt that is paid by illegal taxes is one of the phony schemes set up back then to basically entrap the public. Now, I want to bring up just a small commentary, because I know there's a lot of kids and a lot of parents who listen to this show. And I was talking with some kids the other day, and one of them asked, and this is just out of the blue, the kid came up with this question and said, why do we have to get up every day and go to school, and this regimented thing? I know there's a lot of parents who homeschool their kids, and this kid was one that goes to the like a regular school, or what do you call, public school, whatever. Said, why do we have to get up every day at 6 o'clock and go to this school, and then when we get done, if we go to college or whatever we do, we're expected to work the rest of our lives? And I said, well, that's a very good question. What you're really working for, about 80% of that time, is to pay back interest. And I said, the interest that you're paying due to taxes is interest on a debt that was made for wars that we didn't need. And then I said, by the way, interest is illegal in the Old Testament. There was a certain laws that were to govern the use of interest. And in the Old Testament, in all of the old books that came down to us from ancient times, charging interest was illegal. And these are the common laws. And the reason for that was that it enslaved the population. This has happened before, this method of charging interest, handing out phony money, then taxing the population for phony wars. This method of enslaving the population has happened before. So you can see the entire game plan would be ruined if the population found out that there was a vast amount of free electrical energy in the universe. So you can start to understand why the bad science, the Big Bang cosmology, the garbage about where dust comes from in the solar system, and the stupid, dirty snowball comet model, why that still is allowed to exist, and why these scientists are funded through government science, because they are the cover story, they're the smokescreen, they're the ploy that keeps the power units in power. It keeps big oil, it keeps the nuclear industry, it keeps the coal industry. Huge lobbies. And by the way, it keeps the teacher union employed also. I've always thought that too, because I've spent many years myself in teaching, and I looked at some of the courses and you could teach most of that material in about 3 or 4 days if done properly. And then kids could be turned loose in the library and to go do their own research. And how many times in a school do you see kids in the library? Actually, hardly ever. They might have a time where they go in for 1 hour and quick do some research, and then they quite quick write a research paper and they hand it in, and that's it. Instead, they're locked in these classrooms with hours and endless hours of what I consider useless, wasted time, when most of the material that they learn, as I said, could be learned in a few, 3, 4, 5 days at most. Well, that keeps the teachers employed, gives them a nice pension, and also is one of the other main sources of taxation in the country. About 50% of state and local taxes go to fund the public school system, much of which goes for buildings. New buildings, in a lot of cases, the taxation, the levies, this constant parade of levies in front of the public. And so, once again, that brings up the topic of textbooks, the textbook industry. And I'm going to close on this note, because the textbook industry is one of the largest publishing industries in the world, the United States textbooks industry. They actually have laws in most states which state that you cannot put anything incorrect in a textbook and teach it to kids. Well, that sounds great, but who decides what's correct? And in the case of science, all of our science goes back to NASA and the science that's coming out of NASA, the Big Bang cosmology. The true history of our world is not even taught. The idea that there was a great flood just a few thousand years ago, and that the Ice Age and a great demise of mankind occurred just a few thousand years ago, is not even taught in the schools. It's not in the textbook. The most major affecting event in the history of mankind that has shaped everything, who we are, what we are, that brought in the oil, in the oil industry, that's where a lot of the surface oil came from, that's being used today by the comet that came by, and the great flood came from the comet tail. None of this is taught in the schools because of NASA, because of this bad cosmology. So you find that, as I talk in this show, we have a very large problem worldwide. Everything from the centralized governments, the families that control them, the illegal interest that's being charged, which causes the illegal taxation being forced on you with illegal, stupid wars constantly. They're talking about new ones now. It's just constant, never ending. The price tag going up and up, both in human suffering and in enslavement of the population. And it all comes back to the fact that we don't understand and don't teach our kids the correct history of the world. And it all comes back to the fact that cosmology is completely backwards, and apparently, as far as we can see into the future, the cosmology is going to continue to be taught Big Bang, dust coming from, oh, just goofy stories about that, and the stupid, dirty snowball comet model, all cover stories to prevent the real issues from coming forth. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.